Hi, it's Rob Herman, and welcome to the Super Performers Podcast, powered by 4100 FS. As we worked on developing this podcast, our overriding goal was to create a compelling platform for accessible insights on work and life from successful, driven, and highly accomplished leaders. Leaders with unique experiences across a wide variety of fields, including business, medicine, law, sports, entertainment, education, and philanthropy, among others. In my head, I started to work through a fascinating group I wanted as guests, and I got pretty excited about it. I've gotten to know these people through my own varied experiences early in my career on Capitol Hill, later working on Wall Street and as an investment manager, being an entrepreneur, and now leading a unique and thriving company called 4100 FS, while also focusing on community engagement. I think you'll really enjoy hearing the stories of these guests, learning about their respective paths, finding out what motivates them, and how they define success. Glad to have you with us on the Super Performers Podcast. And without further ado, on to our guest today. Our guest today on the Super Performers Podcast is Michelle Forman. Michelle is an award-winning documentary filmmaker, and her documentary work has been broadcast on HBO, Independent Film Channel, PBS, and Sundance Channel, among others. She gained her early experience as an executive in feature films, serving as director of development at Spike Lee's 40 Acres and a Mule Filmworks, where she was responsible for the acquisition and development of new projects. In addition, she served as associate producer on Mr. Lee's Academy Award-nominated film, Four Little Girls, a feature-length documentary for HBO about the bombing of the 16th Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama in 1963. Her most recent feature documentary, Alabama Bound, tells the story of same-sex families fighting for custody of their children. Alabama Bound won numerous awards during its film festival run, and it's streaming via PBS as part of the series Real South. She currently serves as series producer for the award-winning series Southern Exposure. Michelle is also the director of the Media Studies at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, which she co-founded in 2003. Her work has created a student-produced archive of short documentary films about crucial community issues in the greater Birmingham area. Media Studies has been supported in part by the Ford Foundation Difficult Dialogues Initiative. She's worked to develop the professional film industry in Alabama through her work on developing a film office, consulting on film incentive legislation, and her longstanding role as founding board member and past board president of the Sidewalk Film Festival and Cinema. She began her film work at Harvard University, where she double majored in English and filmmaking. Michelle Forman, great to have you on the Super Performers Podcast. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a wonderful invite to receive.
Absolutely. And we're going to start with the early days of Michelle Forman. We got to start in order. And let's talk a little bit. You grew up in the South. You're a Southern gal. Birmingham native. You came back after being on the East Coast for a while. We'll talk a little bit more about that. But it's interesting. You have two very bright parents. They passed along some good genetic material. Your dad is a super bright and accomplished guy in his own right. But your mom, full disclosure, is my dad's sister. So we're cousins.
I know that genetic material, you know, it's pretty good. Goes both ways, Rob.
So let's talk about your childhood a little bit. And in particular, you know, your mom, like my father, is a Holocaust survivor, but they have pretty different stories. So one of the first questions I want to dive into, because I know you've talked about it before, is your mom's story. I want the audience to hear a little bit about your mom's story and also what your awareness of her story was growing up. For me, I think I embraced what my dad had been through a little bit later in my young adulthood. But what was your experience with your mom and understanding her story and the weight of that legacy?
For sure. You know, I like you, have been, as an adult, trying to understand more of it. But as a child, I really felt that the war was this thing that had happened to everybody's family just because of the way it hung as a cloud over our household. And it was always the war, capital W, even though, you know, you and I, we were kids of the 70s, and probably to most American kids, the Vietnam War was probably the most relevant or recent or current war. But, you know, I think the legacy of what my mom went through as a child, having been born in Katowice, Poland, 1936, basically 3 years old when Germany invaded, you know, the trauma that I think a child goes through, and, you know, you just can't shed that, I don't think. Even though she is one of the most joyous, funny people, it came through in, and I mean, just so funny and has such an amazing attitude. But it came through in a lot of ways. She was very overprotective of me as a child. And that was, she never wanted me to see any of the ugly side of life. One really early vivid memory is, you know, in our house, we always watched the news together as a family. And 60 Minutes was on when I was very young. And they were doing a story on the Cambodian killing fields. And my mother, I've never seen her move so fast. She leapt across the table to try and cover my eyes and ears because she just didn't want me to even be aware that such things happen in the world. And so a big part, I think, of the way her wartime experience made its way through is that she wanted to, you know, erase all those aspects of, you know, the terror out of my life.
Yeah. And it's interesting. We'll talk about your documentary film career later, but I wonder, as I hear you talking about how you connected some of the stories that you paint as a filmmaker versus your childhood and the empathy, I think, that gets engaged in that process. So let's talk about that a little bit. The other thing that's interesting, and I think about it in my own context, having grown up in the Midwest, but your Southern identity, you know, you left for the East Coast for a while, but that gravitational pull brought you back to Birmingham. But growing up in the South, that's, I imagine, a pretty significant part of your identity when you think about your childhood and growing up, even though you left for a time. Talk a little bit about that Southern identity and what it's like to grow up in the South, especially with a mom who's not from the U.S. And it's an interesting identity, I would imagine.
Yeah, it's definitely a unique, I mean, the Venn diagram of my identity is, I mean, it really gets down to a very, very tiny bit of overlap. But, you know, my mom's story, you know, I didn't really know it except in these sort of emotional ways in the South. But, I, you know, the South is very religious, particularly in the 70s and 80s. I mean, I think Birmingham has become a much more cosmopolitan city. But, you know, this is the kind of place that when I moved here, we lived in Atlanta, and then I moved here at the start of second grade. It's the kind of place where people's first question to you, they want to know who your parents are, who's your family, and what church do you go to? And so, you know, the fact that I had a mother who was so paranoid about people knowing about our Jewishness, that made that question all the more fraught. I mean, just because the idea of being Jewish and, you know, and during the war, my mom was too young to know that she was Jewish. So she didn't realize, and she wasn't told that they were Jewish until after the war. She had been raised. I think that's one of the probably the biggest difference between your mom's experience, your dad's experience, and my mom's experience is their age difference. But I think that she didn't know that. And so part of Jewish identity for me growing up in the Deep South was always fraught. You know, it just, yeah. I'd always felt like you were sort of going to be vulnerable if you revealed that aspect of yourself. And I know that, you know, comes through all of those, you know, sort of trauma and aftermath of her experience during the war. But, you know, one of the other things about the South that I really love is that people are really friendly. They're really open in strange ways about their life story. It's a great place to be a documentary filmmaker because people are not stoic here at all. They share every aspect of their lives, whether you want them to or not. And, you know, that that part of the culture was one that really was embracing. So it was a, there was a contradiction having grown up here. Grew up in a predominantly white suburb, and a big part, I think, of my, you know, maturing and my fascination with the South is learning why that was the case, learning about the history and impact of segregation. And I also think, of course, psychologically thinking about our family's story, and how devastating it is to, just persecute difference, how that made its impact in the place I found myself, even though it's a very different history.
Yeah. I do, you know, it's interesting to talk to you about this because it's not something we've talked about before, but I completely relate to what you're saying about that Jewish identity growing up. You know, it's different in the South versus the Midwest, but there's some parallels. And I was uncomfortable talking about it. And to some extent, you talked about your mom and my parents, you know, we I think, struggled with that Jewish identity and how visible to be on that front. And it's something I think that stays with, sounds like, you and me today in grappling with what that means. So thank you for sharing that. And you go through high school. Was it on your mind? You ended up going to a little school in the Northeast called Harvard. Was it always on your mind to leave the South to go to a school, you know, an Ivy League school like a Harvard? Was it on your radar? Or was it something that kind of came later in high school? I imagine in Birmingham, it's not always top of mind for people to think about either leaving the South or going to an elite Ivy League school.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. My high school class, you know, the majority of people, you know, I'd say like the third question in the South is, you know, who are your parents? What church do you go to? Are you for Alabama or Auburn? And that, you know, that the majority of my friends from high school were really thinking that question, are they going to go to Alabama or Auburn? But, you know, I was lucky in my grade in school. I had in my class, just one of those concentrations of great students. And a lot of us wound up leaving. And I think having a peer group like that winds up being really important in being able to set your ambitions, to be able to sort of think about possibilities in a broader context. I mean, there was competition, but, you know, I think a lot of us are, you know, we're still friends today. But that kind of support, I was always a great student, really good in school. It came easily to me. I mean, I'm still in school if you think about teaching. I'm faculty at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. So I feel like I've never really left the classroom. My, you know, responsibilities there have changed, but that kind of idea of being a really good student. So I got a lot of feedback along the way that this was something that I was good at. And, you know, I think that there were certain kinds of key cues beyond teacher feedback or parental feedback and normalization from friends, but things like the TIP program that sadly has been discontinued from Duke University. Like, I think you took some standardized test. I can't remember if it was like the PSAT, but if you got a certain mark on it, got a certain score, you'd get a letter from the TIP program offering you, you know, the chance to enroll in a class on the Duke campus in the summer. So those kinds of things I you know, took on. And I mean, now we're in such an arms race of college admissions, but that was rarer in the 1980s. And those things made a really big difference for me. Funnily enough, one of my closest friends in the world is someone I first met in the TIP dorm when we were 14 years old.
Wow.
You know, yeah, she's, you know, works at the Paul Allen Institute now in Washington and Seattle. And, you know, I mean, I just think about that kind of peer group makes a really big difference in being able to imagine yourself picking up and leaving from your small little, you know, place to these places that have like marquee names like Harvard.
It really, those types of experiences you're describing at Duke really open up your mind to what's possible. What a great experience to be at Harvard. When you went to Harvard, did you already know you were interested in filmmaking? Was that something that, you know, preceded your enrollment, or was it something that developed while you were there?
I had no idea how films were made. I mean, I thought they were like, you know, the tablets that fell from heaven. We had no indie movie theater in Birmingham. I'd barely seen like a foreign film or an art film. I mean, the closest thing to probably an art house film I ever saw was, just a John Hughes movie. I mean, you know, I just can't even imagine, you know, I was such a consumer of just mainstream, you know, movie content that came to the multiplex. And I had no idea who all those people were, whose names rolled in the credits. It was a giant mystery to me how those kinds of things got made. The one thing that's really funny, though, in my senior year in high school, my boyfriend and I were just bored of all the usual stuff that happens on weekends in Birmingham. And we went through the newspaper and we were just trying to find something new to do. And we saw that at the university, at the student center, they were having the Spike Lee retrospective. And, you know, this is like 1988. And so Spike Lee's career was in its earliest days. So that included his retrospective, was his his master's thesis film from NYU, Joe's Bed-Stuy Barbershop, his first feature film, She's Gotta Have It, and then School Days, Playing on a Loop. And so we just thought, we liked his name, knew nothing about it. We showed up in the middle of Joe's Bed-Stuy Barbershop, was a little lost, didn't know what was going on, but it was compelling. And then we stayed for She's Gotta Have It, and it blew my mind. Like, it so blew my mind as this amazing movie. I'd never seen a movie like that. We didn't even stay, even though I wanted to see more of his work. I just, my consciousness was so blown because I'd never experienced a movie that felt like a novel. I mean, I was always a huge reader. I wound up being an English major. I was really into visual art and knew a lot about, painting and printmaking. Those were all things that I also pursued at Harvard, but She's Gotta Have It was like the very first movie that I saw that spoke not in an institutional or studio voice, but like a personal voice. And Spike had published a book, like a diary of making it, that I found in a thrift shop in Birmingham, which I thought was like, you know, great serendipity. And I just pored over that. So that was really the only thing that I had that was a glimmer that individual people made films and how they made films. But it was really when I came to Harvard, started taking art classes and started studying English. And it was really a institutional limitation of Harvard. You can't double major at Harvard. I'll take that back. You can double major, but it has to be under unique conditions. You couldn't be on a parallel track, like I'm going to do painting over here and I'm going to do English literature over there. You have to make an argument to them about why your double major overlaps in a certain area. So I wanted to take those two sets of classes. So I just thought to myself, stories told in pictures, film, and that's going to be the basis of my application for this dual degree. And then I found myself sophomore year having to take a film class so that I could follow through on what I had proposed. And then I fell in love. I mean, it wound up being something so different. So, you know, that set me on my path and set me on my path in so many ways because it was primarily a documentary program, not feature film.
Yeah. So you talk about Spike Lee and you had built this interest and ironically, you know, you can't found your way back to Spike Lee, but you were building this interest in documentaries while you're at Harvard. And talk a little bit about that story of the experience of meeting Spike Lee and then ultimately going to work for him post-graduation. You know, as you built this skill set, I'm not sure that you would have would have scripted it quite as neatly as it ended up happening. But how did that all come to pass?
Oh, yeah. If this were a script, nobody would believe it. That I had my, epiphany while watching She's Gotta Have It when I was in high school. But at Spike, in my junior year, it was announced in the way that Harvard, of course, announces these amazing talents from around the world who are going to come and, you know, become guest faculty, visiting faculty on campus. And I was Spike's number one fan by this time. Every new movie he had, I was there on opening night. I mean, conversion experience completely. But when Harvard announced that he was coming to teach a class, I was blown away. And so he was teaching history of film, history of African-American cinema class my junior year that I couldn't take. But my senior year, it was announced he was coming back to teach a screenwriting class. And they were going to accept like 15 people, and you had to send in a writing sample. And I had never written a script because our program was script-free. I mean, honestly, the program taught me a lot about how to construct a film, how to make a documentary, how to conduct interviews. But it taught me nothing about how to, like, get a job in the business of film. I still didn't know what anybody did on any of those credits, you know, leading up to senior year. But I did have some short fiction from a creative writing class. So I submitted that. It was set in Alabama. And, you know, I wrote a crazy application to get into the class. I'm mortified thinking about what I must have said. It was very gushy. And amazingly, I made it in. And our goal was to write a feature-length screenplay in a semester under Spike's tutelage.
That's ambitious.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, now when I think about like what I ask my students to do, I was like, you guys have no idea how easy you have it. Each week he would fly in Friday morning. Our assignment was to write a certain number of pages on our script to workshop and give to him. But also we were to read a classic screenplay. And then Spike would get out his Rolodex, actually his file effects, if you remember all those great like office tools of the 80s, yeah. Got out his file effects. And we would call the director, producer, or star of those movies on speakerphone.
That's heady stuff.
Yeah. I mean, first week, Chinatown, and we called Roman Polanski in Paris and Jack Nicholson in L.A.
Yeah, that sounds like a pretty unique class, as an understatement.
Yes. And he liked my writing. My script was, I mean, it showed my sort of, you know, my true documentary roots. It was based on a true story, based on a really infamous crime here in Birmingham. It was the murder of a Catholic priest on the front steps of the rectory. Father Coyle was shot down in that period of the height of KKK resurgence and anti-Catholic sentiment in America in the 1920s, sort of part of that wave of anti-immigrant sentiment. And it was, one of those blockbuster murders and court cases. And the murderer was defended by Hugo Black. And it was a career-making case. He got an acquittal. And so the story was really about that sort of intersection of sort of crime, of persecution of minorities, and how that can lead to these, you know, the sort of tinderbox of violence, and then the ways in which the sort of machine of politics can take advantage of these kinds of situations. And so it was right up Spike's alley. He was really invested in the story. I mean, it's a story that a lot of people, I think, in Birmingham know, but not more broadly, and of course, when you think about Hugo Black's future, I mean, how crazy he's the starts off as a member of the Klan and the Klan attorney in this case, but then goes on to be the author of the Brown v. Board desegregation of schools decision. So, you know, it's just really rich with a lot of
fascinating history and story. Yeah.
Just
and like you said, it shows how deep your documentary roots go in terms of uncovering these types of true stories.
And so that did it. That really was, you know, he really liked the script. He liked that I understood how films were made. I usually ask pretty good questions in those sessions on the speakerphone. And then he asked me, what are you doing after graduation? And I didn't know what I was doing after graduation. I gave some dithering answer, and he just got irritated, very impatient. He's just a go, go, go kind of person. And we were in Henry Louis Gates, Skip Gates's office. That was sort of where, you know, Spike would sort of park during his visiting Fridays in the African.
Good place to park.
Yes. Oh, completely. Yeah. In the African American Studies office. And he just picked up the phone and called somebody and hands the handset to me. And I had no idea who I was talking to. And I had no idea what to say. And the person on the receiving end also had no idea what was happening. So we, you know, tried to sort of feel each other out. And then Spike took the phone away from me, tells the person on the other end that he wants her to set up an internship for me for the summer. And that was like, that made my career. That was the beginning.
Yeah, I want to unpack a couple of things from what you just told me. First of all, wow, sitting in an office with Spike Lee and Henry Louis Gates as a college student, you know, that's a pretty remarkable opportunity. But I will say the one thing, and I just want you to comment on this quickly, that as long as I've known you, you're pretty fearless. Talk about, does it take, you know, is it ingrained in you to be able to say, okay, Roman Polanski or whomever is on a speakerphone, I have questions for them? Does it take courage to do that? Or is it just natural for you to say, I have questions, I want them answered, and to speak out? Because a lot of people would be reticent. And you see this in meetings, in classroom setting, in academia, whatever. Most people don't say anything. And talk a little bit about that and any advice you'd give to people in terms of being proactive, because that's about as stressful as it gets with those types of people on the other end of the speakerphone.
Yeah. I mean, definitely, you know, I get very nervous. And the way I deal with nerves is I just try and overprepare. You know, whenever I've got anything that's coming up, I mean, I just try, you know, I come from a family of worriers. I mean, again, really thinking back to, you know, the deep family history and trauma, I mean, good reason there. But I mean, it just means that whatever situation I'm in, I'm really thinking, not just plan A, plan B, plan C, plan D, what are all the possible eventualities out of any given situation? I mean, it's pretty exhausting to live that way, but, you know, it definitely makes it, you know, easier in a hot moment to come in and feel like, okay, I've figured out some of the possible angles and ways this can go. So I'm just going to go for it now.
That's great. So you get the internship, and that leads to, you know, a pretty lengthy tenure with Spike Lee. Talk about day one of whether it's the internship or the longer term role, what that's like, what you're doing, what the experience is like. And I don't know if you had been set on moving, for example, to New York or knew what you wanted to do, but moving from the confines of Cambridge to New York City is a bit of an experience too. I speak from personal experience. You were kind enough when I moved to New York to take me into your cramped Chelsea apartment with many roommates and give me some subway tokens. I'm dating myself with the subway tokens. They don't exist anymore, but it's a big move to New York. It's a big experience working for Spike Lee. Talk about the beginnings of that process.
Yeah, for sure. And I have to say that apartment, that's my biggest regret, is not buying that apartment in Chelsea. That's probably my biggest New York real estate mistake right there. Three bedroom. It was a very small three bedroom. Three bedrooms for $100,000. Can you believe that?
I can't. And my story is similar, not quite as cheap, but I shared a two bedroom, two bath on the Upper West Side near Central Park. And when I heard that they wanted $250,000 for it, I was like, that's absurd. I could buy a house in Cincinnati, a nice house in Cincinnati for that. And we all know how those stories end in terms of your Chelsea apartment, my Upper West Side apartment. We would have been wise to have invested in real estate at that point in time. But yeah, it was a great place. Cramped, yes, but a New York experience to be sure. So what was that like? You know, the start of the work with Spike Lee and in general the New York experience.
Yeah, for sure. A friend of mine from Harvard and I, she's from New York. She and I rented a U-Haul and drove down to New York because my internship was unpaid, which is a real pet peeve I have about entertainment internships, because it really limits who can get their start through that pathway, especially in an expensive city like New York. Because it was unpaid, I found a friend of mine offered a house sitting job for her parents, and I didn't realize who her parents were. He was pretty major; he was a partner at Lehman Brothers, and they had this palatial apartment on Park Avenue. And I pulled up on a Sunday in a U-Haul to this Park Avenue co-op to do my own move-in. I mean, it was the scandal of all scandals. So
first time it ever happened in that building, probably.
Oh, it was a horror show. If you can just picture bringing like my old futon up the elevator. I really thought that was the end of my house-sitting gig, just because nobody thought to tell me that, because in that world, it's unspoken, but I mean, I really was the country bumpkin from Alabama. You could have that Harvard degree, that pedigree, but still, I had no idea. So that put me in a very, very uncertain frame of mind to start work the next day. And, so I was really insecure. I'd take the subway to Brooklyn, find my way to the office, and there really wasn't any orientation. There was a note on the desk that I was assigned to read these two screenplays that were there, and then to like go over at a certain hour to the main office and give my opinion. And I'm still in student mode thinking, not thinking about the politics of any organization, just thinking, I'm here. Everybody wants to hear my opinion, just like when I was a student. So I read these two scripts, asked nobody what they were or their story, and then saunter over at the appointed time and tell Spike, yeah, this one's really great, but this other one is just, it's terrible, so underdeveloped. Both of them were in production. Yep. So that was, that ended that meeting pretty quickly. But then, I was given a number of second chances. A big part of my job was reading screenplays for Spike to executive produce. So this is the era for Spike right after Malcolm X. And so he was probably at the sort of height in terms of sort of cultural currency. And at that moment, for many directors, a lot of filmmakers have hits of their own, of course, but one of the, real hallmarks of your cachet in the industry is being able to get a development deal. That's where the studio that puts out your work invests in you, gives you basically like a venture capital fund to acquire and develop and then executive produce other people's work. And that was a big part of my role. My job was to find those other people, to find that other work. And that was incredibly fascinating. I was uniquely unqualified to do that at 22, coming from a really arcane film program where I didn't know how any feature film got made. But, you know, one of the things that I'd learned in class and through conversations with Spike is that we had a lot of similar sensibilities about movies. And that I think that was really what led to, you know, my ultimate success there.
Yeah. And you made that work. I guess there's some of it, you know, that very overworn cliche, fake it till you make it. You had the sensibility, you had the raw ingredients, but it probably took you a little while to scale that learning curve. And you ultimately went on, you know, as a director of development for feature films, you read a ton of scripts and saw a lot of things. And at what point, let's talk a little bit about a really important film, Four Little Girls, a project that must have meant a lot to you because it was related to the 16th Baptist Church. And the bombing in 1963, given that you were from Birmingham. Talk a little bit about the development of that project. And I don't know enough about your history. I mean, it's incredibly interesting and impressive the way you were able to move and become such a force there. I know you're not saying that because you're too humble to say it, but it's really impressive. But was Four Little Girls the first foray with Spike Lee that you went into kind of this project that had such personal relevance to you?
Well, and I will say that project really had incredible personal relevance to Spike. He has family in Alabama, and that's something that he told me about when I was in his class. He has a relative who started a school in Snow Hill, Alabama. He has an aunt who is a really accomplished piano player. And in his life, he would come down to the South in the summers from Brooklyn. And he went to college, he went to undergrad before, you know, he's always associated with NYU, but he is a Morehouse grad from his undergrad. So he has, you know, a lot of time spent in Alabama and Georgia. And he was, he told me that he was the same age as one of the girls in the bombing. And he said that it really terrified him, knowing that somebody could do that to children, and he was scared. And this was a place that he used to go in the summer, and it was a place that, you know, felt so different from New York. You know, those were, you know, the real drivers for that project to move forward. And it's, you know, and that project is a real anomaly in what most of my day-to-day work was at 40 Acres. You know, I think that, you know, as an intern, I realized I had to figure out a way to make myself indispensable and not a liability pretty early on. And it's a good time sometimes to be, you know, when you're in the early days of any kind of unit, whether it's a startup or a new division in a company, that's a really ripe time for opportunity. And I didn't want to squander it. Spike had been somebody that I had lionized from, you know, my high school years, that had not been, you know, diminished at all by, you know, being able to study under him. And I wanted to keep doing that. And he had just gotten this development deal. And so I really began just using that position that, hey, I'm interning at 40 Acres. I would call all my counterparts, cold call people. You know, one of the nice things about Harvard, it's a pretty big network in the entertainment industry. Any of my friends, I had a friend who, you know, worked for ICM, one of the talent agencies. I had another friend that worked at a literary agency. I just began talking to everybody about how do you do this job? Like, how do people succeed in this job? And that, you know, put me in a position to be able to think about an opportunity when I saw it and just move. And, you know, so those were already parts of our mindset. Spike was working on a feature project on Jackie Robinson. And I mean, that is that's really my biggest New York regret, is that Spike didn't get to make that movie, because it would have been incredible. But that sent us down a big pathway of doing a lot of classic baseball research. And Ebbets Field had been torn down, and the oldest still standing baseball park is in Birmingham, Alabama. And so Spike was scouting locations in Birmingham. And that's when he mentioned to me the impact of the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing on him. And he began asking questions. And I'd already worked with him long enough to know, I mean, Spike is not a small talker. I mean, he is very comfortable sitting in silence if he does not have something to say, and he does not want you to fill it with a bunch of garbage. And so if he said something, by that point, I knew it was significant. And so he began asking questions about the bombing, and I began pulling together some materials. Just we'd already worked together for, you know, about 3 years. At that point, that, you know, I just began giving him reading material, just letting it cook around in the back of his mind. And I didn't know what it would lead to. The Jackie Robinson Project did not come through, and that, you know, this is, Spike is a guy who loves to work. He's one of the hardest working people I've ever known in my life. Exhausting to the level of, you know, sheer human, you know, insanity to work so hard. And so he had the prospect of not having a big movie to make on for that year. The industry was changing and our deal was changing. But I had been in meetings for some other project at HBO, and I knew that they were really interested in getting into any Spike Lee project. And that's when, you know, the idea of setting it up as a documentary really came to fruition, and it came together very quickly in a way that now, I mean, I just can't even imagine having an idea for a project and then getting that much money to start making it. I mean, that's the power of being Spike Lee. But he sent me back to Birmingham to start doing some of the preparatory research, and that really changed the course of my entire life and career. I saw Birmingham from a different perspective. I became very, very close to the families of particularly two of the girls who were murdered in the bombing, but more broadly, just getting reconnected in Birmingham to people that were invested in things that I cared deeply about. And I admit, I didn't realize how much I missed that from my life in New York.
Yeah, well, it's one of the questions I wanted to ask you about that path back to Birmingham. But just to back up for a second, the work you did as associate producer on that documentary for Little Girls that was Academy Award nominated was incredible and compelling, and what an important project to get that out there. And as you said, that work, I think, led you to more consequential and impactful work in the way your career evolved. So incredibly important. I want to come back to that, but I do want to make mention of something that you said. I think it's really important in terms of your success, both in filmmaking, but also in general, when we think about how, whatever your path may be, you really leveraged a lot of contacts and people that you knew were relevant to becoming better at your job and also being successful in what you were trying to accomplish. It's always interesting to me, and I'm curious if you would comment on this. At this point in my career, and I'm sure in yours, especially because you're in academia, you're around younger people all the time, students and people looking for help with projects, film projects, among other things. I offer my help to so many people, and granted, maybe my help isn't that useful all the time, but I know in part it's kind of a pay it forward thing where I used a lot of people's expertise over time to make myself more knowledgeable, but I'm always amazed at how few people take me up on it. Maybe that's an indication of me, but I'm curious if you'd comment on what you see, because you really, you talked about that. You really use that a lot to develop your own career. Do you find people leverage what you do? And just talk about the importance of doing that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was something that I craved when I moved back to Birmingham. Birmingham, at the time that I came back, had a commercial production community, but very little like creative or artistic community. And I wanted to set up, at the time, I did set up a chapter of association of, you know, independent film and video makers and AIVF chapter. That organization has folded, been supplanted by others. But it was sort of the first forum before I met the people that I would go on to work with to help put together our first film festival. There were a couple of people that really had that idea, and they reached out to me. They reached out to another Birmingham kid who'd been in the industry in a really different capacity, Alan Hunter, one of MTV's first VJs, is from here. And so
I remember his hair very well.
Yeah, he's still got all of his hair. He looks amazing. It's like the picture of Dorian Gray. I saw him in August and I was like, Alan, you never age. It's unbelievable. But you know, that need for community, that, you know, that's something that I think has been lost to the social media culture, where it feels like everybody's within reach, but you really don't forge a relationship with them. That's probably the biggest hurdle I see with my students. I do a couple of things in my classes. There's one pedagogy that I use called from the National Honors Conference called City as Text, where you make students go out and walk a number of blocks in the community, and they have to talk to people, cold walk up to people, have conversation in a store, order some food at a restaurant, you know, like just normal human interaction skills. And then in my film classes, I realized in my teaching, I've been teaching now for over 20 years, if you can believe it.
Wow.
But there's been a decline in students' ability to be able to write professional emails and make phone calls. And I used to just tell people to call people, tell people to send an email as a query. And it just, I could tell that something wasn't clicking. And then I looked at what they were drafting. And so that has now just become part of the formal part of the class that we work on together. But I think there's a real reluctance to reach out. I do find a lot of people who are coming to town to make a film, they'll reach out to me to get advice on technical work. Most of my students come back to me for years and years whenever they've got a new project, but that's just the nature of that relationship. But I you know, I'm with you. I've seen a real change in that willingness to just try and reach out. I mean, the worst that's going to happen is someone just could tell you no, or they're going to ghost you, ignore you. But the best part is someone might just have coffee with you and you'll learn something from their experience, or they'll connect you to somebody in their network. So valuable.
Incredibly valuable. Well, thank you for that. And let's jump back now to your return to Birmingham. And so it was one of the questions I wanted to ask you. Was it working to four little girls that brought you back to Birmingham? It sounds like it was. Talk about that decision process. It's hard to walk away from somebody like Spike Lee and all that represents, and also leave New York. You may have always wanted to, I mean, the way I felt after close to a decade in New York, I was ready to leave too. But there's a piece of people's perspective, okay, New York or LA or whatever is the center of the universe. Going back to Birmingham and making films is not necessarily the tried and true path. So talk a little bit about that decision tree and when you made the decision to move back to Birmingham.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, people really thought I was just, you know, jumping off of a cliff to the abyss. That was people's expressions. When people would come and visit me and they saw and understood Birmingham, they understood better why I made the decision, because it's such a cool little city. But I mean, in terms of, it seemed like career suicide. It's just, why are you doing this? But it really was the transformation of Four Little Girls. I just knew that that was the kind of filmmaking that I wanted to do. That was really where my heart was. And the idea that you could use storytelling to be able to increase empathy for someone else's lived experience, to be able, I like, you know, I'm truly an educator. I mean, my place is really in the classroom, but I think about myself as a filmmaker too. And, you know, I think that my job really isn't necessarily to entertain, but to be able to use stories as a way to be able to sort of deepen our understanding and connection to each other. And that definitely is not what drives the industry. I love I love the artistry of film. I'm a huge lover of film and love what other people do. But I think like my strength as a filmmaker is that human touch. So it took a while to figure out how to negotiate that. I mean, it didn't happen immediately. I had a place that I was sort of sharing subletting in New York to just try and keep those costs down, but still a big part of my income was still coming from doing sort of field producing in New York and other independent projects. And then I'd come back to Birmingham to write and try and like get something going here creatively. But it was a long, steep ramp because there was really no industry here for me. There were no women working in film. I mean, Alabama was very hostile to women working in this industry at that time. And that was very different from what I experienced in New York, where the 90s was a really amazing age for women producers.
Yeah, well, you did what you created in Birmingham, that ecosystem, alongside a lot of other pretty important people in the filmmaking business in Alabama is pretty remarkable. And I look at it, you know, your work's been broadcast on HBO, PBS, Sundance Channel, IFC, the Independent Film Channel, others. And so you were able to make that work. What's interesting is that you've done a lot of different things. And I want to come back to the specifics of your filmmaking in Birmingham. But you also developed the film industry in Alabama, as you referenced, and founded, and you're still the director of the Media Studies Program at University of Alabama, Birmingham. Let's start with UAB, and how did that develop where you founded the Media Studies Program and really created something that hadn't been there before?
Yeah, I like starting new things, but this is just one of those things about luck and being in the right place at the right time and recognizing it. I mean, that is so much a part of my career. I can't even.
Well, you got to take advantage of those things. But yeah, luck and being in the right place at the right time is part of it, but you got to capitalize on it, which I think is an important point. But it's impressive, the Media Studies Program there and what you've done, especially with the student produced archive of short documentaries. But if you go into, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but go into that story as well as how it all came to be, because I do think, you know, mentioning what the Ford Foundation has supported for you in the short doc films and what you've created there is part and parcel of that story as well.
For sure. The timing of this, I mean, in Birmingham, after Four Little Girls came out, there was a huge amount of attention in press. It was, again, a great moment for me to be, you know, on site in Birmingham, just because the power of that film, it's hard to even fathom now, given where our national discourse is on race and civil rights. But in the 90s, it was really not talked about. I mean, there was pushback against having a civil rights institute here in Birmingham in its earliest years. So it really had not been part of a sort of reckoning of the past and its impact into the present. And so the timing of that film was very important. And so that was one aspect. The other timing aspect that was very important was technology. This was really the birth of digital video. So, you know, I'm probably the last generation of people who came out of a film program having to shoot on film and, you know, edit on, you know, cutting with a splicer and taping the pieces together. My professors said that a computer would never be able to do that. and then, you know, hit mid-90s and Avid and nonlinear computer-based editing is becoming the, you know, industry standard. But that technology that was so expensive in the mid-90s, by the end of the decade, beginning 2000s, is starting to become really affordable, as all technology does. It's starting to hit the desktop. And I was really lucky that there was an anthropology faculty member at UAB, visiting faculty, who had a sort of vision about what like the implications of that technology was going to be. And he had reached out asking if I could train his grad students how to make a film, because he thought it would be great to see if they could do some, you know, sort of cultural anthropology work, interviewing people, having people in the community themselves tell their stories. And I loved that. Was a beautiful vision to me. That's really what I'd realized. I was just at that juncture of realizing, oh, the power of storytelling is really getting people to understand each other's experiences and what it looks like from their point of view. So, you know, totally down for that. Had no idea if I could teach that first pilot. I was clearly, I could not teach. I was terrible. But there are some very talented people in that class that came up with something that was sort of amazing to me. And I sort of caught the bug. And, you know, the way academia works is you get a grant here, you get a grant there. I had, you know, what was known as sort of a soft position at the Center for Urban Affairs. And then by 2003, we were able to get a formal minor passed, and that, you know, and I was able to be hired as faculty at the university, and that just took off. The possibilities of being able to leverage the position you hold in whatever place, how to extend the resources of the university into the community, being able to, you know, people whose work I admired, just calling them up, finding out whether we could partner on some big projects. That's really how some of the collaborations in the early years, part of that funding came from the Ford Foundation. The Ford Foundation had an initiative called the Difficult Dialogues Project, trying to get, I mean, it's funny, it almost seems like a quaint past to think we were divided then, and thinking about where partisanship and rancor has reached now. But the goal was trying to figure out whether we could use virtual and in-story storytelling to try and diminish some of those, reduce some of those barriers of difference between us. And that's always been one of the sort of watchwords for our program, really trying to think about how do we tell community stories, variety of initiatives through the years. The city of Birmingham's made up of 99 neighborhoods, so we had a 99 neighborhoods project for a while. I've just done a storytelling project with one of our regional parks. It's a repurposed iron ore mining site that's become a recreational area. And I just had students who were interviewing the families of miners, some of the elderly miners, and some of the first historians who documented the history of labor there. And we've created interactive signage along the trails so people could understand the places where they're jogging or going to play in the dog park were also these sites that really built Birmingham. So those are all, you know, those are all ways that I feel like I can, you know, further that anthropologist's mission.
Yeah, mission accomplished. Although I think you talked about partisanship and rancor, you know, and all the things going on in the world around us, those community stories are more important than ever to tell and get out there. And they're not only fascinating stories, they're important in how we think about the fabric of community. If in terms of the short documentary films, if you wanted to find them online, is there a specific URL you can go to?
Sure. I'd say the easiest thing to do is Google UAB Media Studies Vimeo channel, and you can go to our collections. I mean, they're streaming and free online. That's another aspect that I really love. I do a lot of nonprofit media. So the goal is to be able to figure out a way financially to be able to pay that there doesn't need to be an ROI on the film itself, that's covered on the front end so that the back end work can be available for everybody.
Excellent. Well, we talked about you going back to Birmingham and building something bigger than yourself, and it's clear that's happened. I just want to, as we get into what comes next for you, I want to also just mention, and we kind of talked a little bit about this, but you talked about the development of the film industry in Alabama. You worked on a regional film office, film incentive legislation, the Sidewalk Film Festival. All of that's important in terms of what you want to accomplish. You also played a big role in a variety of projects, and including the award-winning Alabama Bound, which is a really compelling story. If you haven't seen it, it's worth watching. It has to do with same-sex families fighting for custody of their children, which was left unresolved by the U.S. Supreme Court in terms of legalizing same-sex marriage. And it's fascinating, especially in the Alabama context. So I talk about all that. Where do you think now, in terms of when you moved to Birmingham and what you wanted to accomplish, where are you on the continuum, and what comes next as you think about your work in making films, in building that film ecosystem in Birmingham and Alabama and the South more broadly? You know, where are things? Where do you want them to go next?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think about when I first started, it was such an uphill climb. Like, anything that was going to happen, I had to be, you know, probably like one of five people that was like working every day to make it happen. And the best part about where film is, particularly film production, is that I am now watching a really vibrant community. Probably, you know, I mean, there are a lot of my students who've been able to make a home here and find a way in all different aspects of media professionally. So I still, that ecosystem is very near and dear to me. But probably half the people working here have no idea who I am. And that idea is, to me, is the idea of success, is that you don't have to be the one that's always pushing the rock up the hill. Now the rock is rolling down the hill, and there's a huge amount of activity that I don't have to be the only one pushing that lever to make it happen. I mean, now it is just happening. And that, to me, is very gratifying, especially, you know, as I'm reaching, you know, a level of energy. I don't have the energy that I had when I was younger. So I'm glad that I don't have to do that. I'm still super involved. I don't mean to, you know, completely, you know, marginalize myself. But that, to me, is success. Like, if it is institutionalized without you, that's great.
Well, because you were the pioneer that made a lot of that happen. You were, you know, it's lonely at the beginning when you're one of the only people doing it, maybe in some cases the only person focused on these things. That's true success. If somebody working in film in Birmingham doesn't know who you are, I imagine most people probably still do. But you know, it means you've accomplished a lot in building something a lot bigger than yourself. So well done. And so at this point, you know, you're busy with a lot of different projects and a lot of different things. Do you still want to make films? Do you want to leave that for others? What comes next?
Yeah, I'm still, I mean, I can't ever say no to a good project. You know, I think I mentioned one of my interests is parks and green space. That's been a big part of my, you know, sort of nonprofit and board participation. I love the outdoors. I love seeing nature. And I also think it's very important for the vitality and health of a city. It's an incredible stimulant for growth and health for a neighborhood to have a park. So I'm working on a transformative park. Our big bragging right is sort of beat out the High Line for a design award. And the Railroad Park in Birmingham. Next time you come down, we'll go for a little walk around Railroad Park. Amazing design, and it's hitting its 15th year. I'd been connected to the park designer through a student film. He saw a student film called Benching, The Art of Watching Trains. That's a great watch. You can Google that one to see on our archive. But he had said that the vibe that those students captured was what he wanted in the design for the park. And then I went on to work on just a short video for his design firm, just to document like sort of first year of the park. He reached out to me now that we're hitting the 15th year. He's based in Berkeley, reached out to me, and we're doing a sort of retrospective of his career and how that park actually came to be. And for me, just as a, you know, urban studies geek, you know, just I can't believe the amount that small, tiny public investment led to billions of dollars of private development around that park. There's not a picture of Birmingham that goes out now that does not feature that park. That's, it's transformative to neighborhoods. So that one.
That's impact.
Yeah, that's my love letter to Birmingham and to Railroad Park. And then my long standing, I mean, it's sort of related, but I've been producing a series of environmental shorts called Southern Exposure for years and years now. Some of my favorite collaborators, because I think they're doing such great hard work.
So many things, you know, you talked about Southern Exposure, another award-winning environmental series, so many different areas you've touched on in terms of community and bigger picture issues. So here's to continued impact and success in your career, and the world around you is better off for you having been part of that. And I also wanted to make mention not only to say hello to your parents, Honey and Perry, but I think the world of your husband, Eric Lizet, who is a senior leader at the McWane Science Center, doing important work on his own. And of course, your brilliant son, Max. We look forward to bigger things to come from him. He's already accomplished a lot in his young life. But Michelle, it has been a pleasure having you on the Super Performers podcast. Thank you for sharing pretty inspirational messages. And again, here's to your career and to your life. It's very impressive. And I've had a lot of fun talking through this with you.
You too. We need to do an episode where you're on the other side of the questions.
I appreciate that. I think your stories are probably more interesting, but I'm looking forward to more conversation to come. And now I can bother you with all the things that you talked about here and ask you endless questions. So it's a lot of fun to talk through it and look forward to more conversations ahead. Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you, Rob.
Listening back to the Super Performers episode with the impressive and accomplished Michelle Forman, here's some brief show notes that I thought represented highlights of the conversation. First, Michelle's background growing up in the South, along with her Jewish identity being the daughter of a Holocaust survivor, makes for a complicated legacy. Her career as a documentary filmmaker and her interest in telling stories about community seems to be connected to her personal history. We heard about Michelle's start in filmmaking and the good fortune of having filmmaker Spike Lee as her professor, someone whose work she'd greatly admired growing up. Michelle scaled the learning curve quickly, needing to write a feature-length screenplay in a semester and having the opportunity to ask questions of legends like Roman Polanski and Jack Nicholson about their work. We discussed the related importance of over-preparing to gain confidence, asking questions in intimidating situations even if you're nervous, and thoughtful networking to build your career and skill set successfully. Michelle's return to Birmingham was in large part based on her producing work on Four Little Girls, an important Academy Award-nominated documentary aired on HBO. It changed her life and led her back to the South, and a career in telling stories and building community through film, as well as her founding the Media Studies program at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Michelle was a pioneer in building the filmmaking ecosystem in Birmingham on her return, especially as a woman filmmaker, and she continues to be impactful in the world around her. She talked about the early days of coming home working on film and how gratifying it is to see how much momentum has been built in Birmingham and the South in that regard. I found the conversation with Michelle Forman to be compelling and truly admire her accomplishments. I'm looking forward to seeing what lies ahead for Michelle. Thanks again for joining us in the Super Performers podcast today, powered by 4100 FS. I hope you not only enjoyed listening, but you found the insights thought-provoking and relevant. We'll be back soon with another episode of Super Performers, Insights from the Driven. This is Rob Herman. Bye for now.